So in a strange way, perhaps the best and luckiest thing about these stress tests has simply been that the gap between them being announced and actually being closed and decided, over that time period, you've seen really quite a transformation in expectations in the market for when the recession ends.
The Economist.
In Washington, D.C., this is The Economist. I'm Greg Ipp, U.S. Economics Editor, and the big economic news of last week was release of the long-awaited stress tests that the U.S. bank regulators and the Treasury Department conducted on the 19 largest banks. The markets greeted the results with relief, with stocks, especially those of banks, rallying to new sort of bull market highs, at least with respect to the rally that's been going on for the last month or two. But just how rigorous were these tests? Should we take much comfort in the results? That's the question I'd like to ask Patrick Fowles, our finance correspondent, who's with me in London right now. Patrick?
Hi, Greg. As you said, I mean, the reaction of bank stock prices has been euphoric since the stress test results were announced. But there are some good grounds to be a bit more cautious about how rigorous those tests are. If you like, they come in two parts. The first is a loss estimate for the banks, which the government puts at about $600 billion. And the second part of the test is to work out how much capital the banks need to absorb those losses. And it's that second part where a bit more skepticism is in order, I think.
Can you explain to me why you're skeptical about that? The loss estimates that they were using, they said these are the worst two-year losses that we're putting into this scenario since the 1920s, worse even than anything we experienced in the 1930s. Are you saying that the question isn't the losses that they might suffer, but how much capital they should actually have on hand to deal with those losses?
That's exactly right. It's all to do with the size of the buffer. So what they set as a minimum is a ratio of core equity, so the core money stockholders are put into to each bank. And they've said that that has to be 4% of risk-adjusted assets. Now, to give you an idea, the IMF recently came up with its estimate of what the minimum should be and came up at 6 to 9%. If you look at some of the European banks that have been bailed out, RBS in the UK is a good example, the minimum has effectively been set at over 10%. And it's interesting to go back to your comparison with the 1920s. Back then, the same ratio was between 10 and 15% for US commercial banks. On most yardsticks, the new minimum level is really about as low as you could reasonably go.
From my point of view, the part of the test that I find the most troubling is that the adverse scenario that they used to determine, well, just how much money could these banks lose, is not really that adverse. I mean, they said, well, imagine that the unemployment rate goes above 10% and that the economy shrinks 3% this year. Guess what? That's actually the baseline scenario of a lot of forecasters, including the IMF. So this could hardly be characterized as a worst case scenario. It's more of a middle of the road scenario. But what do you think, Patrick? How much comfort should we take from this? And do you suspect that in some sense the tests were massaged to try and produce a number that was satisfactory to the banks?
There does seem to be quite a bit of anecdotal evidence that the banks put up a successful lobbying campaign to make sure the tests themselves were not that stringent. And in fact, there's really only two big banks who've been forced to or asked to raise substantial new amounts of capital. I think where the government seems to be going is to have a thinly capitalized system which still enjoys an implicit state guarantee, and that's why it retains confidence. And to give you a nice example, although quite a few banks have been trying to sell stock, that is common shareholders' equity, in the last couple of days, several have also tried to raise bonds which are not guaranteed by the government. And the price they're paying is really very high still. For example, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs have all issued bonds which yield an interest rate of about 4% higher than the government. Now, that suggests investors still don't think these banks are particularly safe investments without a government guarantee. And obviously, it goes without saying that were those banks forced to continue borrowing at that kind of interest rate over a sustained period of time, they would not be viable businesses.
I would like to give the Treasury a bit of credit on one thing, which is to do these tests, because it's not generally appreciated that they didn't really have any regulatory mandate to force the banks to go through this sort of exercise. The banks, by their standard regulatory procedures, were all reasonably well capitalized, and the accounting treatment, as I understand it, only requires them to reserve for losses over the next 12 months, and so asking them to do so over the next 24 months pushes them beyond what they could reasonably have expected to adhere to prior to this period. So there was a delicate issue here where the Treasury, in some sense, had to truly test the limits of their own legal powers to force the banks to go through this exercise. And it's no wonder that they got so much pushback, both in public and in private. There's only so far they could push them before they risked, for example, legal challenges to what they were doing. The other constraint that they were operating under, although they don't like to talk about this, was the fact that if they had produced results that had asked for hundreds of billions of dollars of fresh capital that the private markets were simply not prepared to supply, it raised the question of, well, could the federal government supply that money? And the Treasury only has about $100 billion left in the so-called Troubled Asset Relief Program, which has been used to build up the capital reserves and various other things, such as bailing out the automobile companies. It would have, I think, raised a lot of doubts about their ability to provide the type of stability the banking system really needed if the test had disclosed a requirement that was much higher than that. And I thought it was interesting that in the last week, we've seen a definite change in the posture and the rhetoric coming from the Obama administration. 2 or 3 months ago, it was the world is in a really bad shape and we're facing a unique crisis and many conflicting self-reinforcing downward pressures on the economy. And we must act aggressively on fiscal stimulus, on mortgage relief, on bank stability to respond to this crisis. And now, helped, of course, by the more upbeat economic data, they are talking about green shoots and how we've turned the corner. And there are glimmers of light. What I find a little bit unsettling about that rhetoric, however, is that surely they know that the economy is still in an extremely fragile state. We just learned on Friday that 500,000 jobs were lost in the United States and that the unemployment rate continues to soar. And it's far too early to say that we've stabilized things for the long run. Moreover, to simply say we have enough money to keep the banks from failing is an awfully low bar. I mean, the problem in Japan wasn't so much that the banks were all failing left, right, and center. It's that they were so burdened with bad loans that they couldn't provide fresh capital to a growing economy. And I'm not certain that we have, with these stress tests, assured ourselves that not only will the banks be solvent, but that they will be healthy enough to be willing and enthusiastic suppliers of fresh credit to the U.S. economy.
I agree. I think the timing has really been both fortuitous and absolutely essential to what's happened, because I think had they come up with both this minimum hurdle and the demands to raise capital 3 months earlier, when the market was far more pessimistic, a completely different scenario would have unfolded, which is the market would not have taken the minimum hurdle at face value, and probably the collective judgment would have been it was far too low. And secondly, those banks that would need to have raised capital would have been unable to raise private funds, necessitating the government to step in and purchase voting stakes in the banks. So in a strange way, perhaps the best and luckiest thing about these stress tests has simply been that the gap between them being announced and actually being closed and decided over that time period, you've seen really quite a transformation in expectations in the market for when the recession ends.
Tell me what the experience is in other countries. Is any other jurisdiction conducting anything similar to this, and can they learn anything from what the United States has done?
Well, I'm afraid to say the European view is if America is in modest denial, we're in complete denial. The big difference between the US and European banking systems is American firms have a lot of securitized assets on their balance sheets, which they tend to mark to market prices, and therefore losses show up really quickly. In Europe, the bulk of banks' balance sheets are still loans, and bad debts are written down slowly. And what that means is the damage to banks' balance sheets really has not yet begun to show in its full severity. So you've seen a couple of bailouts of big banks like RBS or UBS in Switzerland. But generally speaking, I think what we're going to see is the realization over the next 12 months that some kind of capital raising on a widespread scale is necessary in Europe.
Do you think that we've seen the bottom in the financial markets and in the bank stocks?
I don't actually, I'm afraid. I think we've had a pretty euphoric period. And if you look at the underlying valuations of bank stocks, taking into account all of the bad debts we're about to see, they now actually look quite expensive. It's probably a good time to raise equity for banks, but I'm afraid the people buying new shares in them may be somewhat disappointed.
So I guess my lingering concern here is that for all the good efforts that the administration here has done and what other countries are doing, is that they're still adding up to a muddle-through approach. We have not seen the aggressiveness that, for example, the Swedes brought to their situation in the early 1990s, or that Korea did under pressure from the IMF in the late 1990s. The United States thought about and then walked away from the bad bank option, which was perhaps the first best way to cleanse the system of all the bad paper that's clogging it up. And so what we have here is an amalgam of banks that are being kept alive in private hands. They will be fed this intravenous drip of capital as necessary to make sure that they remain healthy and solvent. But we have a banking system that is still and will not be under these scenarios capitalized enough to do the full job of providing credit to this economy, especially considering that the so-called shadow banking system, the non-bank sector, remains moribund with the Federal Reserve's asset lending program designed to bring that market back to life, still operating with a very low level of activity. You add it all up, and I worry that we're probably a little bit closer to the Japanese scenario than we are to the Swedish scenario.
I think what we're looking at now is a very thinly capitalized U.S. banking system staggering on for 2 or 3 years, reliant on government guarantees to turn over its debt and borrow funds in the market. And ultimately, I think it may, with the benefit of hindsight, come to be seen as a rather expedient choice compared to the alternative of simply ramming the banks full of capital, be it from the government or private sector, to the extent that they are unambiguously well capitalized. Politics has, I think, played a pretty big role in the stress test process.
That's about all the time we have today. In Washington, for The Economist, I'm Greg Ipp.
And in London, I'm Patrick Fowles.
The Economist.